this week on the Northwest Politicast.
Seattle voters continue to be frustrated with a lack of action on homelessness and crime.
We find that we have majorities of people in favor of almost any solution you propose. So it's like these issues have been here for a long time. Do something.
Bremerton's praying coach fails.
Yeah, we got practice on Monday. Absolutely.
By Wednesday morning, Kennedy turned in his resignation.
Plus, Southern lawmakers smacked down by the courts.
Voters in the state of Alabama, black voters, had their voting power diluted.
And more damning evidence in the case against Donald Trump, but this time, it's coming from his own lawyer.
He warned the former president that if he does not comply with a duly authorized subpoena, that the FBI will get a search warrant and they will bust into Mar-a-Lago and they will take the documents themselves. And that's ultimately what happened.
Now, reporting from Seattle, Jeff Pogula.
Well, we begin this week with a bit of polling data, specifically on the races for Seattle City Council. Now, we're not going to dive into each of the seven district races. Obviously, polling there would take quite a bit of time and quite a bit of money, but we're taking something of an overall snapshot of the direction of the City Council and the way voters want the new council to go. Joining me now is pollster Stuart Elway, who conducted the poll for not only Elway Research, but Crosscut as well. And I guess, first off, what's the top line out of this poll? What are you seeing the most?
Well, we're seeing the same issues that have been on the public agenda for a number of years are still at the top of the list. Homelessness, crime, affordable housing, policing, drug abuse. Those issues have, as we know, been named by people for several years as the top issues in the city. From there, the consensus sort of splits. But we find that we have majorities of people who are in favor of almost any solution you propose. So it's like these issues have been here for a long time. Do something. That's the overall sense that we got.
So would it then be fair to say that voters want change? They just don't know what that change would be?
We ask people, you know, as you're looking at your vote for the council, are you hoping to significantly change the direction of the council or modify it a little? And it was essentially even. 44% said they wanted significant change and 41% said they wanted to modify it a little. So that's 85% who want some change. And as I say, with four new council members, we're going to get some change at least. But 44% want significant change in the council. And then we ask people, are you more inclined to vote for a progressive candidate or a centrist candidate? And as you pointed out, we're not doing this district by district. So this is overall combined across the seven districts. 49% said they were inclined to vote for a progressive candidate, and 37% said they were inclined to vote for a centrist candidate. Then when we asked them in their district, it was one-third centrist, one-third progressive, and one-third undecided. So it's the city council is up for grabs.
So is it fair to say that voters are still trying to struggle with what exactly they want? Obviously, they want change, but the direction, as you say, still up for grabs as to where that change is going to go or what that's going to look like?
Well, yeah, a bit of that. I think a lot of what's happening now, of course, with these four vacant seats, voters have a lot of work to do sifting and sorting through all these candidates. There were, 45 candidates in that primary, and now there's 14, but most of them are new names, so people are having to figure out who those folks are and where they stand. But as I said, we had two-thirds in favor of hiring more police officers and 72% in favor of creating a new department for non-police emergency response. So people kind of want both. They want some immediate action and in terms of hiring more officers and getting a hold of crime, but even more people support the longer term structural issues that people talk about that lead to crime and homelessness in the first place.
You take a look at this year's numbers, 64% favor hiring more police officers and providing more training. That's up 10% from when you asked that question the same time just 2 years ago.
That's right. That's right. So there is movement in that direction. I think the crime issue and the, you know, just the condition of downtown it's been front page and in people's face for some years now and not really seeing enough progress.
But at the same time, you only have about a third of people saying that the condition of downtown is an important issue. Again, some conflicting numbers there.
Yeah, well, that's and that has actually dropped a little bit. The crime issue is spread from more from downtown. You can't open the paper or listen to the radio all day and not hear about a shooting somewhere in Seattle. And I think that is really having an effect on people's perception of crime. And that's so that it's spread beyond downtown.
Obviously tied into the issue of crime is homelessness. But right. Yet you ask a question on the issue of homelessness. If you had to choose which approach should have the higher priority for city government resources, one, moving tents out of parks and public areas and moving their occupants into temporary shelters, or two, developing permanent housing and mental health services for people experiencing homelessness. And by a wider margin, 55% want developing permanent housing and services, and only 41% say moving the tents out of public spaces is important.
Right, which hasn't moved at all in the last 2 years. We got almost exactly those same numbers with that same question in September of 2021, leading into the mayor's race. As I say, people are still in favor of doing things to address the structural problems that lead to homelessness in the first place. Although, you know, there's still that 41% is a sizable constituency for let's move the tents out of downtown and deal with the permanent housing later.
Does it seem in your mind that Seattle voters are less inclined to seek an immediate solution to a problem, but rather want something broader and bigger?
You know, I think they want both. I think they want an immediate visible solution, but to understand that that is not really a solution. The broader structural issues still need to be addressed, and there's a strong constituency for that throughout this survey. Another measure of that is we asked people if they were more likely to vote for or against someone who supported Mayor Harrell's agenda, and 45% said they'd vote for someone who was with Harrell on these things, and only 15%, so 3-1, people appreciate Harrell's agenda. And we've seen in other polls that he's getting pretty good marks. We didn't ask a job rating for him in this poll, but others have. And he's getting fairly positive marks. And I think it's sort of that balanced approach of let's have these cleanups and let's do some removals, but not lose sight of the fact that we need to house these people and give mental health more attention.
Regardless of what solution you pick, it's going to cost money. Seattle's yes. already an expensive place to live, has some very high taxes, and the state has the high gasoline tax. So people are taxed quite a bit if they live in the city of Seattle. But right. yet voters are still willing to tax themselves even more, according to your poll.
Yeah, at least tax some of our neighbors the more. You know, we didn't ask, would you support a tax yourself? Except when one time we did. There were four questions about taxes all in a row, and people were split on whether there ought to be a moratorium on the new jumpstart tax, which has been proposed, and it was pretty even for or against that. But by almost 2-1, they supported new taxes on Seattle's largest businesses, and by 2-1, they'd support taxes on highest income people in Seattle. But then we asked about the proposed housing levy that's coming up, which is going to add about $260 a year on the medium Seattle household. And 57% said they're probably going to vote for that. So it's in keeping with our reputation in Seattle of, you know, never seeing a tax we don't like.
Well, you go back and you look back 4 or 5 years, and we saw the fiasco that was the proposed head tax on Amazon. It seems voters' opinions on that have changed significantly since then.
It looks like that, although, you know, it's not named the head tax here. And the question was some form of new tax on Seattle's largest businesses. And of course, you know, once one's proposed, then opposition also forms, and then you have the real debate. But what a survey like this will measure is where people's inclination, sort of where's their default position, their starting point. If these tax proposals took form and were actually on the table, this is where they'd be starting from.
So bringing this back to the races for Seattle City Council, as you drill into the numbers for the various issues, whether it's public safety, policing, taxing businesses, taxing residents, what does it tell you about the election coming up in November?
It looks like now, as I said at the beginning, the city council is up for grabs. I mean, that's obviously true since there's four open seats. But when we asked people how they were going to vote, as I said, it was about one third each of centrist, progressive, and undecided. Nobody has a majority. So it could break in these last 8 weeks all one way. I mean, it could be the moderates take over City Hall and sweep the progressives out, or it could be the opposite of that, given where the numbers are right now. Or probably the most likely is it's going to be some version. There are going to be some progressives elected or reelected and some centrists added to the council. Statistically, I would say that's the most likely event. But what it really means is these decisions are all going to be made here in these last 10 weeks. And so the campaigns are going to matter, and the energy in the campaigns are going to decide what the council looks like come November.
Looking back, is history to be our guide? In 2019, we saw a lot of polling data that indicated that the city council might shift towards the middle a little bit. That didn't happen. A lot of people put the blame on the multi-million dollar ad drop that Amazon put in supporting their preferred candidates and push back against that. Are we seeing similar headwinds this time around?
I think that blame was kind of well placed. The polling before, as you said, that Amazon big money drop was pretty clearly in the centrist direction, but it caused such a backlash that it just changed the complexion of the race. It'd be amazing if somebody made that mistake again, one way or the other. Of course, you know, we don't know. There's, 8 weeks till election. And with it being so undecided, or at least the final results being so unpredictable at this time, there's going to be a lot of temptation by people on both sides to get more involved. So we'll see what form that takes, I guess.
Should be a very active last 2 months of the campaign. Pollster Stuart Elway, thank you so much for your time and insight.
My pleasure.
Still to come,
some of the worst numbers yet for the current president as an unexpected Republican overtakes him in the polls.
When the Northwest Politicast returns in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogela. Last segment, we spoke about some polling data when it comes to the city of Seattle and the tight races that the city council members find themselves in there. But now, zooming out, let's look at some polling data when it comes to the race for president. Obviously, we're still over a year away, and so take a single poll for what it's worth. But nevertheless, almost half of voters say that any Republican presidential nominee would be a better choice than President Biden in 2024. That is astonishing. And that's not the only astonishing number in the poll. Joining me now is Brittany Shepherd with ABC News. And I guess this is really bad news if you're the president.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky. This is a new poll from CNN. It's a bunch of hypothetical matchups between Biden and all the major GOP folks running for president. And in all of those different matchups, there was no major GOP contender who really rose to the list, with one exception. That's former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, the only Republican woman really majorly running for president. And this is tricky if you're sitting in the White House right now. Biden is currently running 5 points behind Nikki Haley, 49% Haley, 43% Biden. There's broader support here for Haley than any of the other Republicans. And it's interesting because if you punch out even further and look at these like general Republican polls, Haley's kind of hugging around the fifth, sixth place mark. So you might be surprised it wouldn't be a DeSantis or a Mike Pence. But this recent Republican debate just a couple weeks ago gave Nikki Haley this tremendous runway to say, look at all these guys fighting with each other, getting down the mud. If you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. That was one of her big applause lines. It seems that momentum is growing and growing in a time when Republicans are worried that Donald Trump is general election toxic, even though he's so popular in the primary. The worry is, if he is elected, it really wouldn't translate to a general election electorate who would want someone a little bit more reasonable with all the political and, of course, tremendous legal baggage of all of these indictments.
Well, we kind of want to be careful when we compare polling numbers with the Republican primary race. That's obviously Republican primary voters. which tend to be much more extreme than, well, primary voters of any party tend to be much more extreme. Then you look at these hypothetical matchups. These are general election voters, regardless of political affiliation, correct?
Correct. And that's why that delineation with Trump is so integral, because like you said, within his party, he's doing gangbusters. I think in some polls shows him almost up 60%, you know, just leaps and bounds among all these other folks. But when you translate it to a general population American, including Democrats, independents, folks who might swing from not voting at all to first time voters, younger Gen Z voters, they are, you know, not bullish on Trump at all and clearly not bullish on Biden. And Biden really needs a broad tent, not to just keep his numbers from last cycle, but expand his numbers to have the insurance that he doesn't have to worry about trying to get a whole bunch of Republicans to flip to him, which is a lot less likely. Which is why someone like Nikki Haley, the Republicans are trying to brand as general election ticket safe, somebody who is conservative by all the, you know, kind of natural bona fides, but isn't as bombastic, will blast you on Twitter or X or their own social media profile, won't be getting into all these legal problems, and someone who seems that they can appeal to Democrats, independents, even if they don't all align perfectly on policy.
So where is Nikki Haley's support in this poll coming from? Obviously, it takes a while to dig down into the crosstabs and things of that nature.
Right.
But we heard so much about Trump and vis-a-vis the Republican Party's vulnerabilities when it came to suburban women in 2020. Is that where Nikki Haley's starting to pick up some steam and eat into Joe Biden's lead?
I think we're seeing it broadly with white Republican voters with college degrees more than anything. And I think you are. I'm not seeing the women's breakdown right in front of my eyes, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's where it was. This election will be lost or won in the suburbs, and suburban moms have so much power. You know, the education issue has become kind of in the bullseye of cultural issues for Republicans and Democrats alike, school choice, what's on their child's curriculum. And Nikki Haley has really taken that up as a bastion of the conservative party to say, you know, here are common sense reforms for schools. I want to empower parents, but I also want to, you know, make sure that moms have a say. I want to make sure that women have a say. And that's a very appealing message to someone who might be on the fence, you know, in a suburb, who says, you know what, I might be more liberal for some certain social policies, but I might want someone who better represents me as a human. And that's a good thing if you're Nikki Haley, and a pretty tough thing if you're someone like Biden, who's already fighting stereotypes about his age, his mental fitness, and his general acuity.
Have we seen any response from any of the candidates, or for that matter, the president, to this poll?
Not exactly, but these kinds of issues have been brought to the White House and President Biden's team before. And you're kind of eschewing any of these comparisons and saying, look at Biden's record. He has a strong approval rating with Democrats. He's delivering when it comes to the economy, when it comes to support of Ukraine, and trying to say that we'll let his record speak for himself.
All right, Brittany Shepherd with ABC News from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for your time.
No worries, anytime.
Coming up next,
is one of Donald Trump's lawyers turning state's witness?
When the Northwest Politicast continues after this.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogelow. Well, prosecutors in the classified documents case against former President Donald Trump are revealing more evidence they plan to bring against him, including voice memos recorded by Mr. Trump's former attorney. ABC's Stephen Portnoy joins us now on the Northwest Newsline, and these recordings don't include Mr. Trump himself, but were all about his actions during the investigation and his reaction to the subpoena from the Justice Department. So how do these recordings help prosecutors make their case?
This is really rich evidence, Jeff, because these appear to be contemporaneous notes taken by an attorney for the former president, Evan Corcoran, who talked into his phone, the voice memo app, about what was going on in the spring of 2022 prior to the FBI going into Mar-a-Lago to seize the classified documents. This is when the former president had just been presented with a subpoena. And the question was asked by the former president to his attorneys, well, what if we don't comply? And what Evan Corcoran says, according to transcripts of these voice memos, is that he warned the former president months before it happened that if he does not comply with a duly authorized subpoena, that the FBI will get a search warrant and they will bust into Mar-a-Lago and they will take the documents themselves. And that's ultimately what happened. So this is going to be evidence that the former president knew what he was doing when he was not complying with the subpoena, because his attorney advised him of what would happen if he didn't comply with the subpoena. And some of what Corcoran says in these voice memos, you can read in the indictment. What we learned this week is that that information came from these voice memos on Evan Corcoran's phone.
So how is this not privileged attorney-client information?
It's a really good question. And in fact, it's a point that the Trump campaign is making. A Trump campaign spokesman put out a statement in response to the ABC reporting that reads as follows. The attorney-client privilege is one of the oldest and most fundamental principles in our legal system. Its primary purpose is to promote the rule of law. Whether attorneys' notes are detailed or not makes no difference. These notes reflect the legal opinions and thoughts of the lawyer, not the client. The bottom line is, Evan Corcoran is a key witness in this because what the former president is accused of doing is hiring or having some of his staff, including his body man, his top maintenance man at Mar-a-Lago, move boxes around Mar-a-Lago so that Evan Corcoran wouldn't know they were there, so that he and other people on the legal team could certify to the Justice Department that all the classified documents had been removed from Mar-a-Lago. And the most recent charges, which were amended in July, have the former president accused of trying to have the video footage of the boxes being moved around Mar-a-Lago deleted.
On the issue of attorney-client privilege, I imagine that this is an issue that Donald Trump's lawyers are going to be litigating quite a bit.
Well, I think to the extent that it might be, it probably already has in other cases. There's what's known as the crime fraud exception, which essentially vitiates attorney-client privilege when a lawyer is involved in a crime.
And in this case, he's obviously a former attorney and now turned witness in the case. How is that expected to affect the prosecution's case? Because certainly it sounds on the surface very damning evidence.
Well, it doesn't help the defense's argument that the former president didn't do anything wrong. When the charge is obstruction of justice and you have an attorney who is either willing to say or there's evidence that the attorney informed the client that he risked being held accountable by the Justice Department, well, that's going to be an argument that the prosecutors are going to make to the jury. What you hear from the former president's attorneys is that none of this really should have mattered because the former president was entitled to keep these papers under their reading of the Presidential Records Act. You won't see it in the text of the Presidential Records Act. I've read it myself. And while I'm not a lawyer, I am familiar with the law and case law around it and experts who helped to write it and who have presided over its implementation at the National Archives. And what those lawyers tell us is that the clear intent of Congress after the Watergate scandal was for government papers produced by an administration to be retained by the American people and stored in the National Archives. Now, Trump's lawyers would say that, yes, but there's a delineation between materials that are produced by an administration for the president and papers that might be personal to the president. And he should have the right to decide for himself what is personal and what isn't. Well, Trump would argue that all these papers that he had in Mar-a-Lago were his to keep, that they were personal, that they were not government records, and that only he could be the arbiter of what's personal and what's presidential under past rulings with respect to the Presidential Records Act. He may have a point there, and there may be something for the Trump attorneys to sink their teeth into. But when it comes to the obstruction charge and all the other things that went on around this question of whether he should or shouldn't have it, that's where the prosecutors are going to have their best argument.
So whether it's these notes taken by his former attorney or that tape that we heard several months ago of the former president saying, oh, I could have classified this, but I didn't. Oh, you really shouldn't be looking at this or something to that effect. The case seems to be really building for the prosecution.
Well, and we're getting a glimpse of it. And I don't know the sourcing that my colleagues who've reported this, where it emanates. But what you can observe from a distance is the idea that the prosecutors have a great deal of evidence, audio recordings, video recordings, witness testimony that collectively paints a picture of an attempt on the former president's part to have these documents, hide them from authorities, keep them for whatever purpose he intended to keep them for, and everything else be damned.
All right, ABC's Stephen Portnoy from Washington, D.C., thank you so much. Thanks, Jeff. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump's social media startup appears to be on life support, but it has gotten a bit of a lifeline. As Drew Harrell reports in the Washington Post, the parent company of Truth Social was granted a financial extension. And he spoke with Northwest News Radio's Frank Lindsay.
Drew, let's start with who Digital World Acquisition is and how they intend to do business with True Social.
They are an investment company. They're one of these blank check companies known as a SPAC that raise a lot of money from investors, and then they take a company over in a merger and then allow that company to be traded on the public market. So this has all been sort of a big investment deal that is now 2 years old that was, you know, once like the key to unlocking the Trump business empire and endeavor on the internet, but it's just been 2 years of problems, and they've now gotten a deadline to kind of extend this episode even further.
If the extension hadn't been granted, what would have happened to Truth Social?
In 2 days, Digital World would have liquidated. They would have given all of their money back to shareholders, and all of that $300 million was supposed to be the lifeline for True Social. So True Social would have been in a really tough spot. It's still in a tough spot, really. I mean, this is a Twitter competitor that Trump uses and not many other people use, and it is sort of struggling to become a functional business. So that money will go a long way to helping it sustain itself, but it still has to actually finalize the merger. It still has to finish this deal that they promised 2 years ago. And this extension allows them to keep trying for another year, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the deal is finally sealed.
And this isn't the first extension. Why is this thing taking so long?
Yeah, they did a whole other extension battle last year. And that's the big question, right? You know, with these SPAC mergers don't typically take that much time. They're typically done within a year. You know, both sides kind of come to the table, they agree on terms, they file documents with the federal securities regulators. But here, you know, this has been a 2-year process. There's been all kinds of drama. There's been board members accused of insider trading. The SEC has accused the company of misleading investors about how they started and how much the Trump company knew. So there's just been a lot sort of happening behind the scenes that we haven't really understood why it's been taking so long. And the company has continuously had to go to investors and say, give us more time. We can make this right. We still want this deal to work.
That's Drew Harrell, The Washington Post, speaking with Northwest News Radio's Frank Lindsay.
Still to come,
Republicans in the Deep South slapped down for racial gerrymandering.
When the Northwest Politicast returns in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogelow. Well, this week, a panel of three judges struck down Alabama's latest congressional map, saying Republicans continue to gerrymander congressional districts to dilute the power of black voters. Now, this isn't the first time a court struck down a GOP-drawn map, with the Supreme Court even getting involved at one point. Joining us now is Megan Velasquez of The Washington Post, and all of this has to do with the Voting Rights Act. So what exactly are the details here?
Essentially, the court has ruled today that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was not complied with in the latest map, alleging that voters in the state of Alabama, black voters, had their voting power diluted when the map that was created did not include a district which had something quite close to, that's the wording, something quite close to a black majority. So there's one black majority district in Alabama, and what was proposed was a second 40% black voting population, which the court ruled today did not meet the requirements.
And this is what, the second go-around here for the Alabama state legislature drawing these maps?
It sure is, and this issue has already been weighed on by the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this summer. The court stood with the lower court's ruling that the map did not meet the requirements as brought forward in the Voting Rights Act. And so now you have a unique situation where a state legislature has essentially failed to comply with a court order on a matter like this. And in the order that was brought forward today, that's noted. I mean, the language in this order suggests that these judges are not so happy with what the legislature, the GOP-led legislature, brought forward.
So effectively, as you say, the judges are saying that the Republican court-controlled legislature ignored that court order. So What's the remedy here? Because usually when you ignore a court order, you're found in contempt of court.
So what they're going to do, what the court has decided to do, is to take away that map drawing power from the state legislature, granting that to a special master and a cartographer. And what's interesting is that things are going to come pretty close to the deadline here, because the Secretary of State in Alabama has requested the map be provided no later than October. And so now this cartographer and this special master have until September 25th, that's just a few weeks away, to come up with three new plans.
And this is all for the 2024 elections, because we're getting pretty close to campaign season. In fact, it's already started in some races.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And once these plans are submitted, parties in the case and interested individuals can file their own objections. And essentially, this could escalate further and end up in the Supreme Court again. Now, however, legal experts I've spoken to have said that might not be something that the court wants to rehash once again just a few months after they ruled.
Now, in Alabama, the state legislature draws the maps. I think that's an important distinction, as opposed to states like here in Washington, where we have an independent commission. That effectively lets lawmakers in Alabama choose their voters instead of voters choosing their lawmakers. This is, of course, the Deep South, so the GOP is firmly in control. And it appears, like you said, even after this court order, they don't want to give up even a slight bit of that control.
Right. And I also think it's important to emphasize that this case has broader implications. There are other cases in states like Georgia and in Tennessee that are challenging the current makeup of proposed maps, essentially making similar disputes that Republicans in the state are illegally diluting the power of Black voters, and that their maps in their states need to be redrawn as well.
This isn't strictly a GOP issue. We've seen Democrats try to gerrymander districts in other states, such as Illinois and Maryland, haven't we?
That's right. And in New York as well. It's an issue that seems to emerge sort of on a timely basis in the subsequent years after a census is conducted and get those maps redrawn every decade or so.
So what's next in this case?
So in this case, we're going to wait for those maps, those new plans that are drawn by the special master and the cartographer. We're going to wait for whatever disputes the plaintiffs and the defendants in those cases may have. And then it may escalate further, and whatever map is chosen may get disputed down the line and end up being challenged once again.
All right, Megan Vasquez with The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next,
some conservatives are upset with Bremerton's praying coach.
When the Northwest Politicast continues after this.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Poge. Well, the other big political story from the Northwest this past week was Joe Kennedy. If you remember that name, he is Bremerton's praying football coach, as many people had dubbed him. He came back for one game, and then decided to call it quits. And now a lot of people on the left and right are criticizing just how he's handled this whole situation. Joining me now to get his take is our great friend of the show, Mr. Ari Hoffman from Talk Radio 570 KVI. And first off, let's give a little background. It's been, what, 8-9 years in the making. Joe Kennedy, assistant coach at Bremerton High School, praying on the sideline. His case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Ultimately, they sided with him and ordered the district to give him his job back, but it seems like he really didn't want it.
Yeah, it seems like at this point, now he's trying to figure out what to do with himself. I don't know if he misses the lights. I don't know if he misses the attention, the Friday night lights, mm-hmm. perhaps. But one game and then you're out of there? If that was just to make a statement of, I got my job back, I'm here, I won, I'm out, that was the wrong way to do it. What he could have said instead was, I did this fight not just for me, but for everybody else who wants to pray in sports across the land, because mm-hmm. we have the First Amendment, and I don't feel comfortable working for this place that doesn't want me. I don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And everybody would have hailed him as a hero, on the right especially.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody would have gone, he's the greatest guy. Let's make the next Disney movie. Remember the Coach Kennedy, whatever it is, right? And now it's kind of like, well, what are you doing now? You selling a book? You selling a movie? What's going on?
Yeah, he's got media rights for his story, the whole bit. He's certainly cashing in on this. And from what I understand, he's going to be doing a book tour as well.
I don't fault him for cashing in. What I fault him for is the one game back. Mm-hmm. As somebody who volunteers a lot with kids, as somebody who works with kids, as somebody who has kids, you don't bail on your students. Mm-hmm. You made a commitment for a year, just like you would expect those kids. If they made a commitment to the team for a year, a coach makes a commitment for the team for the season. At the end of the season, you want to say, you know what, I just don't feel good about this. You left the team without a coach after a game in the middle of a season. You don't do that. And that leaves a really bad taste in my mouth.
Well, and from the very beginning, this, at least the impression that I got, and from the coverage that I've read and the coverage that I've done, is that this may have started, as we've talked about off the air, with good intentions, but once the lawyers got involved, that's when it became a circus.
Look, I know from when I first started getting involved in local politics, the lights are very attractive. Right now I have a job in media, right? I do. Yeah. I can speak from experience on this. First, you're volunteering for all the right reasons, and then it's like, well, I really like this whole TV thing and all this attention and things like that. And then you kind of, they forget about you. You know, the story goes away. And then some people just can't shake it. Some people need that light on him all the time. I'm not saying he necessarily is. I mean, I've interviewed him before. It's a fine interview. It's nothing special. But at the same time, it may be somebody who's like, well, I can cash in on this more, or this can be my career. I can go on a speaking tour, and I'd rather be doing that. I got a taste for it. I'd rather be doing that. But really, the whole thing comes down to, you don't bail on your team in the middle of a season. You want to say, I'm done with this? Fine. Everybody respect it. Finish out the season.
This seems like a lot of parallels to someone that we were very familiar with about 15 years ago, and that's Sarah Palin.
How so?
She bailed on her term as Alaska governor to do her little media tour, and we saw how that turned out.
Let's be fair that a lot of them, when they run for higher office, are like, wow, I'm the center of attention, and now is my moment. I think that's not necessarily a Sarah Palin thing. I think that's a politician thing.
Yeah, but she bailed in the middle of a term.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you, but she's not the only one who's done that before. So the thing for me is, once again, that only feeds into what I'm talking about, where, you get a taste for it, and you go, well, I was the governor of Alaska, and nobody cared about me then. Nobody even knew what my name was. But now that I'm the center of attention, get a little makeover, write a book, whatever it is, and I'm off on the road.
So where do you think this goes for him? I mean, we obviously have reached out to Joe Kennedy for an interview. His people have not gotten back to us. They didn't get back to the Seattle Times. Obviously, you've talked to him, but that was months, years ago, and he hasn't gotten back to you either recently.
Right. We did reach out and ask for an interview again, just out of curiosity, like, hey, why'd you do this? I didn't really expect a response because I see he's not getting back to anybody, but I expect what you'll see is a book comes out, it's very big in churches. A movie comes out, it's very big in churches. It's very big in conservative media. He'll probably do another media tour. We'll probably start getting press releases. Hey, do you want to have him on? And I'm going to say, no, thank you. Because if it comes my way, I'm going to say, like, if you did it for your faith and you did it for your students and you did it for the next generation, why didn't you finish out the season? If we do have him on, that's the first question.
All right, Ari Hoffman, talk show host with 570 KVI. Thank you so much.
Pleasure as always, buddy.
And that'll do it for this episode of the Northwest Politicast. If you like the show, please leave a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts. And for more, be sure to check out our other shows, such as Northwest News This Week, Life Beat with Marina Rockinger, Puget Sound Now with Bill Swartz, and Deeper Dive with Kim Shepard. All are available at nwnewsradio.com or on your favorite podcast app. I'm Jeff Pogelup. Thank you for listening, and have a good week.